Welcome to episode 5 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
And I'm film watcher Greg Ruff.
This episode we're going to be talking about our confessionals this week, which mine is Akira Kurosawa's Rashomon.
And I've got Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times.
And we'll be revisiting the Australian film Lantana. So let's start with Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times. Modern Times, a 1936 silent comedy film, portrays Chaplin as a factory worker employed on an assembly line. In fact, he becomes part of the assembly line in such scenes as screwing bolts at a very high speed and also being fed by an employee feeding machine in one of the film's funniest sequences. Most people would remember the iconic scene of the tramp falling into the giant machine. He sends the factory into chaos, then gets thrown into a psychiatric hospital. He recovers and is now unemployed, only to be mistakenly arrested as the instigator in a communist demonstration. These sorts of mistaken mishaps go on and on in this film, every sequence brilliantly performed and directed by Chaplin. He runs into an orphaned girl, Ellen, Paulette Goddard, who runs from the police after running away from the orphanage and stealing some bread. They forge a relationship where they do their best to help each other, finding a rundown house to live in until they both find work together in a cafe, which ends in a very funny climax where Chaplin's tramp actually sings. When the authorities finally catch up with her, they both escape again. The end scene finds them walking down the road at dawn towards an uncertain but hopeful future. Modern Times ended up being one of Chaplin's most popular films, even though it didn't actually do so well commercially in the US, but it was profitable in other countries. The film was predominantly silent, with voice used sparingly, even though talkies had already made their mark in cinema. Written, directed, scored, and performed by Chaplin, Modern Times was his first overtly politically themed film. Chaplin later directed The Great Dictator. Modern Times deserves to be put on a pedestal as one of the great films for its portrayal of desperate unemployment and the harsh conditions people faced during the Great Depression. A clever, witty, and very funny, unflattering portrayal of industrial society. So what did you think, Greg?
I'm sorry, I just thought a silent film deserved a silent review. Okay, what did I think? I thought it was great. I really thought it was great. And I sat down and I watched it with my wife and my 10-year-old son. And what really took me was how engaged he got with the film. So this is a modern child with a silent film. Mm-hmm. The downside was that because it was silent, he felt that he could ask me questions all the way through.
Yeah, sure.
So, you know, when there's the scene with the strike, what's going on there? Mm-hmm. Why would they do that? You know, all the way through. That was a bit annoying. But he was really engaged. And you didn't mention, I think, the scene where Chaplin is roller skating in the department store and keeps going near the edge of, you know, the balcony, whatever it is, while he's blindfolded.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that Chaplin was, you know, a great acrobat in vaudeville days and so on, but I wasn't processing how he did it. I had to go and look it up.
Sure.
That it was a painting on glass in front of the camera. I just didn't pick that up. But every time he got near the edge, my son was going, "Oh!" Just, you know, because he thought he was about to go over. He was totally caught up in it. I didn't like the singing scene as much as you did. I liked it, but I really liked the scene where the ship got loose from its moorings and sank. I was giggling during that.
Yeah.
When it started, I was thinking, am I going to like this or just appreciate it?
Yeah.
And when he got to one of the early scenes where he was doing the repetitive tightening of bolts, mm-hmm. and then the woman comes over in that 30s dress with the black buttons down the back, and he starts tightening those. And then later on, you know, that archetype of the stout matron in the street
with the buttons
on her breasts. And he goes to tighten those until something happens and he doesn't.
Yes.
You know, that was juvenile, but I was loving it. And there was something later on. I really liked the roller skating scene.
Yes.
And it's interesting, you said that the two main characters forge the relationship, but what you didn't mention, probably intended, was it was very much a romantic domestic relationship as well.
Yes.
You know, the little coffee table, kitchen table, whatever it was in that falling down shack.
Yes.
Was, you know, it was really quite lovely. And I could see, you know, the political intent there. So I had to go and check, but Henry Ford's assembly line launched in 1913.
Mm.
So by this stage, assembly lines have been there for about, you know, close to a quarter of a century.
Right.
Where you had what used to be meaningful work broken down into these little segments so it could be a more efficient machine.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're doing is not terribly enriching or meaningful. And I think his commentary on that was, you know, superb.
Well, I think the Great Depression happened because of the industrial world's growth.
Oh, okay, yep.
I think that's where I see Chaplin's going with the film. And, I mean, he really pushes it quite far in terms of the futuristic nature of the industrial world. The screens, the employer looking over you.
And it felt a bit like Metropolis, you know, in those scenes. Mm-hmm. Actually, the other scene I loved was the feeding machine.
Amazing. That opening whole 10, 15 minutes to me is my favourite part of the film. And I love it because every time I turn the modern times on, I just watch that first and I'm into the whole film because it's just brilliant. And the feeding machine.
But the little mouth wiper that came around every time and you knew it was going to come around and you got the payoff of it coming around. And every time it happened, I think I was giggling because I just love that little touch that kept going around and around like the machine did.
You know, you said you watched it with your son. I watched it with mine, who's 5 and a half. And it was great to see him appreciating him, you know, even from today's, you know, computer animated things. But he was loving it. He was cackling with me, especially that scene. He was cackling. And at the very end, he actually got very moved at the end when the authorities come into the cafe and go to take away Paula Gardin. And he was saying, "Don't go away, get away, get away," to the authorities. "Get away, you farty bum," he said. So it was quite amazing.
You know, I had a similar experience a few years ago now where I sat down to watch Buster Keaton's The General with two of my nieces who then would have been about maybe 15, 16 and a couple of their school friends around the same age, and they all really got engrossed in it. And it reminds me that those films, they get old, but they don't get old. You know, they still engage people, the really good ones.
I feel that the slapstick comedy never dies, especially with kids. I mean, you know where the term slapstick comes from, don't you?
Is it the paddles in the face? No,
it's from an instrument in the Commedia dell'arte, which is the Italian masked comedy from 400 years ago.
Yeah.
The character of Arlecchino,
who was Harlequin. Yeah.
Used to carry around a batoccio, which is a slapstick, which is two pieces of wood which were together at the bottom, and every time he used to whack a character, it'd make a slapping sound.
Oh, okay. No, I didn't know that.
And that's where the term slapstick came from.
So I knew there was a reason that I come here. Good, yeah. Thank you.
So but that whole slapstick comedy, I mean, it works so well. I mean, you see it in everywhere in terms of the comedy. The whole slipping on a banana peel sort of comedy will always work with kids and always work, you know, with adults as well. I mean, I found myself really cacking myself laughing, and I love Chaplin. I'm a very big fan of Chaplin, and I find myself still laughing.
I thought there was a curious omission in the story. So when he gets carted off at some point to jail, and you see the jail scenes, you see the scene where he accidentally ingests cocaine in the salt shaker and then goes all weird.
Nose powder, you mean. Nose powder.
And so you've got that scene, or that series of scenes in the jail and what happens to him there and how he gets out with a letter of commendation from the warden, which then becomes a device later in the story. What you didn't see, which I thought was curious, was after he had the breakdown early on from the factory and got carted off in the ambulance, I was half expecting to see some kind of scene in that healthcare system, but you don't. Suddenly he's back, he's dropped off in town or something.
That's right.
He's all cured and he goes out into the world again. Mm-hmm. And there's no sense of what happened there. And if you get, it's going to show the jail, and I understand why the jail scenes are in there.
Yeah.
But not showing the health scenes, was that an artistic decision?
Yeah.
Was that because that was all too difficult or what? I don't know. I find myself wondering about that.
Mm.
And you mentioned in the intro about the fact that it was almost entirely silent.
Yeah.
Because when there are a couple of spoken bits, like the head managing director,
that's right,
the boss, talking to the guy who, you know, the buff guy who would turn the wheels to make it all go faster.
That's right.
And he actually spoke. That was a bit of a shock because I wasn't expecting it. And then I had to go and check and think, okay, was this actually, were they doing talkies then? Because it's 1936, isn't
it? That's right.
And when was the jazz singer? About 33, 35? Wasn't long before.
Yeah.
So a bit before. And so I hadn't realised that it was from the talkie era until that happened. Because I was thinking, oh, is that something someone's put on later?
Well, he was very reluctant. Caught me by surprise. He was very reluctant to go into talkies, Chaplin. I think one of the things he said was, if the tramp talks, he's dead.
Actually, I think I heard that, yeah.
And I think at the very end, of, you know, when he does sing, He doesn't talk, he sings. So it's a difference. Whereas in The Great Dictator, which is really the first movie where he does talk throughout the film, and I think at cinema at that point, I mean, everybody was going to talkies and it was just starting to really take over. But he was very reluctant.
What did he sing? Was that Alouette? Something like that? Or... I can't remember now.
It's the French song. It was a French song.
Is it Alouette, Gentil Alouette, that one?
No, I don't think it is.
What was it? Oh, I've forgotten.
It was another one, but I don't even know the French song, but I loved it, you know. I thought it was just very funny. But anyway, so what will you give Modern Times?
I'm giving it a 10.
Yeah, I'm giving it a 10.
And it's interesting that it's at that kind of bridge from silent into talkies,
yeah,
and is quite literally a bridge in that it's mostly silent except for those parts. But the fact that, you know, as I say, when it started, I was thinking, oh, I don't know about this. And then it really not only engaged me, but engaged my son and so on. The way he was going, oh, when it was near the roller skating blind scene, and the fact that it mixed comedy with those more political elements, even right. You know the ambivalence of the character. He gets the job as the store detective with the letter of commendation from the warder, then realizes that the supposed thieves breaking into the store are actually starving and just want food, and he loses the job because he helps them, and he kind of switches in his funny ways. And I just thought, I thought it was superb, so 10 for me.
Yeah, I agree with you with the 10. I mean, I wouldn't give it for every Chaplin film. I think, there are classics of Chaplin, but I think this is possibly his one of his best.
And a real maturity of the storytelling.
Yeah,
I
mean, you can actually see within Chaplin, he looks a little bit older as the tramp in this film. And you can watch his early silent films when he's the tramp and whatnot, but this one here, just it does have that maturity, and I think definitely a 10 for me.
Okay, so this time Ricardo's confession film, one he's not seen before but I think maybe he probably should have, is Rashomon. Is there such a thing as pure truth? Can you trust an eyewitness's account when they may have a vested interest in what happened? Well, these are the questions posed by this 1950 film set in feudal Japan and directed by Akira Kurosawa. In the story, a notorious bandit crosses paths with a samurai and his wife in the middle of a forest. He lures the samurai into a trap and then rapes his wife, although in the bandit's version, this becomes seduction. And his interpretation of events through the lens of self-interest is at the heart of this story. There follows a trial for the murder of the samurai, but not apparently for the rape. Each person's testimony presents a quite different version of what happened and how, even down to how the samurai actually died. Unusually, even the dead man testifies through the services of a medium. The story of the trial is told to a commoner by a priest and a woodcutter, who have both been witnesses at the trial. This framing story takes place at the derelict city gates known as Rashomon, and the film ends there with a new moral challenge for these three men. So, Ricardo, what did you think?
I really loved the film. I think Kurosawa was ahead of his time a bit with this film. A bit like, say, when I watched Kubrick's The Killing, he's a bit ahead of his time in terms of using a great structure, which I don't think... I mean, I haven't seen another film at that time when it was made... use that structure of one story, you know, and the different perspectives from every story.
Well, it's become known as the Rashomon effect. Although with a slight twist, perhaps, in that in the way it's been carried forward is where you get stories of an event or series of events from different perspectives and they're not true or they're only partly true, but the final story is the truth. And I think that's actually what happens in Rashomon, but you're left, you know, being asked, well, is the woodcutter who tells the final version, you know, the passerby witness, is he actually telling the truth because he does have a vested interest because he took something quite valuable from the scene of the crime?
Whereas the bandit's obviously going to have his own version and bolster himself up.
Yes. So in his version, you know, he actually forces himself on the wife, she kind of relents and he actually seduces her because he's the great lover.
Yeah. I thought the bandit wasn't telling the truth when I was watching his version. I was thinking, no, he's definitely making a lot of stuff up.
But what a great performance. Yeah, that whole the physicality and the kind of like an overgrown child.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And in the forest scenes in particular. In the trial, you know, his kind of rantings for me were maybe a little bit too far.
They were
In the forest, well, he wasn't the only one.
Yeah.
Yeah, the medium and the wife also.
In terms of the scenes in the courtroom are very theatrical. It's like
and very beautiful.
Well, it's like somebody sitting. It's like when you go to a theatre performance, and you're sitting there watching an actor and the other actors just go side stage.
Yeah, and a little bit. And so you've got the main witnesses, so yeah. You know, the medium for the dead samurai, the wife and the bandit, and you've already heard from the kind of the side witnesses, who are the priest and the woodcutter, who are then always sitting in the background. So it wasn't the other actors, because you didn't see the others later.
Yeah,
it was right. Those two who were, you know, if you like, representing the general population.
Yeah, it just
who
had
were
that
always
feeling,
sitting there, you know? Listening to those stories, but beautifully sparse, you know, and in black and white too.
Yeah, really well done.
And that was one of the things for me watching this film, because I have seen it once before a long, long time ago, and I think I saw a really poor version, because I remember it being a much darker or grainier film, to the point where even I had remembered the city gates as being sheltering under a bridge during the rain. You know, it was just...
Oh, wow. That's
I don't know how clearly version. I saw it. Yeah. And this one, and you know, as you know, I just got a Blu-ray player, so I got to watch... It was a DVD, but on this.
Yes.
And it was beautifully crisp. And the effect of light throughout the film, in the courtroom, certainly... particularly in the forest, and even in the city gate. I mean, there are only three sets in this film. There's a city gate, which is, you know, engulfed in a rainstorm.
Yeah.
You've got the beautiful sunny forest with dappled light and little breezes and so on.
Well, you know, Kurosawa in that movie actually wanted to use natural sunlight. I actually shot into the sun a lot of the time.
And with mirrors.
Yeah.
Hmm. You know, I hadn't realised the visual subtlety of the film. Plus, as I say, it was a long time ago, and I really enjoyed it this time around.
Mm.
You know, and in fact, I feel like I need to go back and watch it again.
Well, it's interesting. You talk about the performances, how being a little bit over the top. I found that as well. And in fact, when I was watching it, I was going, "This is reminding me of a silent film in some ways, in terms of the performances in silent film. They had to go very large and over the top." When I was reading up a little bit about Kurosawa, apparently he was a very big fan of silent movies, especially the opening sequence when the woodcutter is telling his version of the events early on. It just reminded me of a silent movie when you saw the hands sort of in the foreground. And apparently Kurosawa actually lived with the actors and they all stayed together. And
he said he was directing the whole time.
That's right, which is a bit like a theatre show, you know, in some ways. You're rehearsing, and you get to put on your performance. And I felt like that was what the actors were doing.
Yeah, it's funny. I was reminded of a different genre. I was reminded of films from around that time that are kind of Hollywood or sometimes British fantasy films. I was reminded a lot of a film I know you haven't seen, A Matter of Life and Death, made by Michael Powell, where there are a couple of scenes in the forest where it was almost kind of impish, magical, and I found myself thinking of those films. It was really, yeah, there were real subtleties to the film, and interesting that you and I pick up on different things in different ways.
Yeah,
I found
the scene which really was the most really inventive was when, you know, we're hearing this perspectives of the priest, the woodcutter,
and the commoner,
and the commoner, and when we actually hear the perspective of the dead guy.
Oh yes.
through a medium.
You don't often see that in Law and Order or something, do you?
Which is, that just blew me away. It was quite a spooky scene, because it wasn't the woman, the actual female character playing that role.
Yeah.
It was the guy, the dead guy playing her, was it?
It was a female actress, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but I don't know. Was it the female actress, or was it the dead guy in makeup?
I say probably
it didn't
not.
Look like because, her.
Well, the one thing you haven't mentioned yet, and I'm probably completely culturally ignorant here, but the wife and the medium had the most amazing eyebrows I've ever seen on screen. I mean, they were like little Hitler moustaches, one over each eye.
They were.
And his face, the samurai actor, his face was nothing like that. Mm. So I don't think so. If so, it was a very quick transition. I don't think so. I'd have to go and look.
But what a scene. What a sequence.
Oh, yeah, I know. And it's such a novel thing that, you know, the murder victim testifies in real time and yet can't tell the truth either.
Absolutely. Well, that's the thing. I was thinking, obviously, the dead guy can, and that's what they talk about it in the film, you know, the dead person can't lie.
And yet he was.
And yet he was.
As we find out.
Yeah.
I found, initially, the reactions of the priest to the whole story a bit over the top. Like, he was so rocked in his view of human nature, I think not so much by the events, but by the fact that these stories were so different.
Mm.
And I sat there thinking, oh, I just don't know about this. But I think this time around in particular, I watched the film very much in the context that was made in 1950. And I was reminded of our conversation before about the Bicycle Thieves being set in the aftermath of war in Rome in Italy.
Yep.
And how you very much have to watch that film in that context. And I think that's the same of Rashomon. So Rashomon came out in 1950, so it was made, let's say, in 1949, 1950. Mm. So it's only 3, 4, 5 years after the war and Hiroshima. And I told you, because I mistakenly thought that Rashomon was the Japanese word for truth, and I'm totally wrong about that, I think.
Yeah.
But it's the name of the city gates. And absolutely. The city gates, which, you know, is the entrance of the city and, you know, the impressive grand social order kind of entrance to the city is the thing which is falling apart and which the characters are breaking up and burning as the story goes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what this story is also about, as well as about truth and who can you believe and trust, I think it's about breakdown in social order. So you've got this thing where, you know, a very feudal, rigidly structured society and the rules are broken and, you know, the honourable people don't behave honourably, even in death, mm-hmm. you know, the samurai lies. And at the same time, this story is being told by a filmmaker and actors and so on in a context where they've come out of the war very, very badly. I would assume their faith in, I think it's Emperor Hirohito, was very badly shaken. And here's a culture that's in shock, in disrepair, trying to make sense of what happened, the different narratives.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know if I'm reading too much into it, but certainly this time around, I felt like, you know, that's what the story is about, directly and indirectly. And therefore, the priest's reaction makes more sense to me, that it's about, you know, not just that people can do bad things, but also that his faith in society and social order is broken down. And yet, what I think is interesting that we haven't mentioned yet is what happens at the end of the film.
Yeah, the climax is quite interesting. So, you know, with the finding of the baby
in the back part of the city gates.
That's right.
And the response of the commoner and the priest and the woodcutter
mm-hmm.
to the finding of that child.
That's right.
So the commoner, who's been very, you know, quite jovially, you know, hanging it on the woodcutter and saying, yeah. "Well, you know, you're not honest either. You obviously took that dagger."
Absolutely.
But he makes off with the kimono and the amulet.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got a very venal, you know, materialistic perspective. But the woodcutter is actually going to take this child home and make it part of his family.
Well, he says, you know, one more won't make a difference.
And I thought it was interesting. Which is quite interesting. You couldn't see the baby's face.
No, you couldn't.
That I think it was a boy. You sort of saw the edge of the face at one stage, and I don't know if the hairstyle was a indicator of gender.
I don't know whether it was a boy or a girl. I just saw, you know, he's going to take this child back.
But for me, it made the child more of a symbol or a metaphor as well, that this is actually, you know, the hope of the future.
It was a wonderful film, and just technically...
And beautiful black and white.
Beautiful black and white. The cinematography was amazing. I'm going to give it 8...
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's, well, some people call it the greatest film ever made. I won't call it that. I'll give it an 8.
Yeah, I'm giving it a 9. I really think it's up there. And I think what it did in terms of narrative structure, as best I understand, is that it, you know, was something really quite novel and has been extremely influential on all kinds of films and TV shows and probably novels ever since. So I think...
Oh, absolutely.
I'm even bordering towards a 10, and maybe afterwards I think, oh, it should have been a 10. But I think...
Mm.
I'll give it a 9. There are just a few bits that jarred me a little bit, like the length of the scene when you first see the woodcutter walking through the forest.
Mm.
And the performances in the trial were a bit histrionic, but maybe that was the intent, that they're all putting it on to have, you know, the drama of their story conveyed as being the truth. So I'm not sure about that.
Mm.
But just lovely subtle touches, even the breeze. You know, the breeze that if it hadn't happened, the bandit wouldn't have really paid attention to the couple going past.
That's right. Yeah.
And he mentions the breeze, but then you see it kind of ruffle him, and it was just nice little touches all the way through. So I think I'll go 9. And that was Rashomon.
So the film we're revisiting this week is the Australian film Lantana. Released in 2001, Lantana is an engaging character study, a fine, elegant and mature adult drama. Directed by Ray Lawrence, with a screenplay by Andrew Bevel, Lantana begins with an eerie move toward a lantana bush, which we discover has a body hidden in it. And from this moment, the mystery begins, revolving around a multitude of very well-developed characters. Psychiatrist Dr. Valerie, Barbara Hershey, who has just released a book about the murder of her daughter, which has strained the relationship with her husband John, Jeffrey Rush. Homicide Detective Leon, Anthony LaPaglia, who is having an affair with Jane, Rachel Blake. Sonia, Kerry Armstrong, who suspects her husband Leon is unfaithful and thus has counselling sessions with Valerie, detailing her thoughts. Another of Valerie's clients, Patrick, Peter Phelps, reveals details of an affair he is conducting with a married man, which Valerie suspects is her husband. When Valerie suddenly goes missing, Jane suspects her neighbour, Nick, Vince Colosimo, has something to do with it. Look, there's a lot going on here, but the film connects all of these stories so well. It's a masterclass in ensemble storytelling, which is up there with Robert Altman's Shortcut and Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia. Suspicion, trust, lies and deceit all play a part here in this brilliant film. The performances are all first class, particularly Anthony LaPaglia and Kerry Armstrong, who are just brilliant. The final shot of Leon and Sonia dancing, so vulnerable, looking into each other's eyes as if they're about to discover themselves again, gives me tingles every time. What do you reckon, Greg?
You know, it was odd. When we talked about watching this film, I was saying to you, I remember going to see it at the cinema when it came out, and I cannot remember anything in the story.
Mm.
And that's really unusual for me. I mean, you name, for example, an Agatha Christie book, and I'll tell you the plot.
Yeah.
A film sure. I've seen, particularly a film I liked, and I did like this when I saw it. And I'll tell you the story, I'll tell you what I think maybe some themes are, if I can remember it. I'll tell you who was in it. I could remember a few actors in it, and I've forgotten many more, but I couldn't remember anything. And even when I was watching it, I knew I'd seen it, but I didn't feel like I knew what was going to happen next.
Yeah, yeah. I had the same feeling, because I saw it at the cinema in 2001. I remember seeing it. I remember loving it at the cinema. But again, it's been so long, 14 years, that I actually had I'd forgotten most of it. So
yeah, but I can tell you other films I saw then and before then and recall them. I don't know what it is about this film, whether it's just particularly subtle or something, but I just could not remember anything. And that kind of intrigues me.
Yeah, I think I'll remember a lot more now. I think so too. I think watching it again, I loved it just as much as I did the first time I'd seen it. I remember coming out of the cinema. I remember the feelings of myself coming out of the cinema, just being blown away by this story and by this film. And again, I felt the same way.
I watched it this time from a very different perspective. Once I'd seen it this time around, I remember that last time I watched it as a murder mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And not only who the murderer is, but also whose body, because you don't know whose body it is until well into the film. And a couple of times you suspect it's this woman or that woman in the film. But so I watched it as a mystery, and I also watched it as a film where all these characters kept crossing paths and that, you know, interconnectedness. This time around, actually, the interconnectedness started to annoy me a bit. And right. I love that in films, but I think actually I like it in more lightweight comedy drama films. Mm-hmm. In this one, after a while, it started to feel a bit forced. You know, I love the scene where Anthony LaPaglia turns up as the policeman to take a witness statement, and he not only is taking the statement from the woman he's having an affair with, mm-hmm. but it turns out when a husband or ex-husband, whatever he is, answers the door,
that's right.
he's actually a guy he had a deep meaning for in a pub.
That's right.
A few days ago.
Exactly. Glenn Robbins, he's so good. I mean, everybody's
no, sorry,
good.
No.
You know, you didn't like Glenn Robbins in that.
Well, say what you want to say first, and I'll tell you why.
No, it's okay. Keep going.
Well, one of the things that pulled me out of the film was that sometimes the interconnectedness was just a little bit too cute. You know, and for example, the guy who runs into Anthony LaPaglia and gets the bloodied nose you don't see again.
That's right.
Turns out to be the man that his female cop partner has been sort of longing after from a distance in a restaurant.
That's
it's the same actor. It's kind of like...
Yeah.
I think I liked that the first time around. This time I sort of thought, oh, no, it's all a bit cute. But the other thing that pulled me out was some of the casting. And three people in particular. Peter Phelps.
Was wonderful.
No.
He was wonderful in the film. No. I'm not a massive fan of Peter Phelps, you know. But I thought he was fantastic in it.
No, there was a scene when he's in the psychiatrist's office.
Yeah.
And he's sort of challenging her. And then he did something. He picked at the arm of the chair or something.
Mm.
And I suddenly thought, oh, I think he's trying to be a gay character here. I felt like he was acting. I didn't...
No, he
didn't feel right in the story. And
Because you know Peter Phelps, though? I mean,
I know a lot of the actors, and I have to say sometimes that was the problem. That was certainly the problem with Glenn Robbins. I'm so used to him doing light comedy and Uncle Arthur and Kel Knight and so on. But I just didn't... Even though I thought he did a good job, I didn't quite believe him as... the husband who's trying to be sensitive. No, it pulled me out of the story.
Mm.
And even, I know, as you said in the intro, you really like Kerry Armstrong.
Oh, I love
her. A lot of the time I did, but a couple of times I thought, that's Kerry Armstrong being
Kerry.
Oh,
no, I did. You cannot. You cannot fault Kerry Armstrong in this film.
Oh, I can. I just did.
You cannot fault Kerry Armstrong in this film. She is really... so good in this, and she plays vulnerable so well, and she's so amazing in this movie. I can't believe you could even fault her performance at all.
Look, I'm sorry. I thought there were moments.
And Glenn Robbins, come on, I could see through it. I could see past his Uncle Arthur face. I thought he was quite okay. I mean, at least he got a small role.
And that's it. He was quite okay. I just think maybe another actor could have done more with that. Kerry Armstrong, I agree. There were moments when I thought she was brilliant, and I agree that last scene where she and you know, her husband, and they've both been through, you know, betrayal and doubt and trust issues and so on within the marriage, where they do that dance number, and you had the vignette with that beautiful, I assume, South American song.
Yeah.
I went and looked it up. It's a song about searching for a lost love, which is really interesting.
Oh, that's lovely.
So you've got these little vignettes of the different characters and where they end up, and, you know, things have worked out for them or they haven't. But then you come to, and you've seen him and her at the start of that sequence, I think, and then it comes back to them doing that dance where they're both, as you say, they're both kind of rediscovering each other and very tentatively and, you know, and so on.
Oh, that I've got tingles again.
Was absolutely superbly done. Oh, it was superbly done, you know, in some of the other scenes of him and the doubt. There's just a couple.
That just shows you, though. All that is a dancing. It's a dancing thing, but it shows you how far it's taking you with the characters. And LaPaglia is phenomenal in
LaPaglia,
this film.
LaPaglia, really, Jeffrey Rush. I'm not sure about Barbara Hershey. And I kind of wonder why we needed an American actress in that part.
No, I didn't mind. It didn't pull me out of the story at all.
No, it didn't pull me out of the story, but I just sort of thought, look, she was okay in the part.
Yeah.
But Robertson, LaPaglia, a lot of support actors.
When he cries at the end of the film in the car.
Yes.
What a very...
Listening to the tape of his wife's psychiatric session, yeah.
Yeah.
When she finally says, you know, yes, I do love him, still.
Oh.
I agree.
I mean, he's had this bottled up, you know, and he says during the film, you know, I don't cry, sort of, you know.
I'm numb.
You know, But then when he does, apparently LaPaglia had to actually have a dialogue coach.
I heard that, yes. He lost his Aussie accent.
He lost his Aussie accent.
All that work in America.
Yeah.
But I can't fault his performance at all. I totally agree with you.
Oh, he's amazing.
Vince Colosimo, in one way, was, you know, I thought, oh, that's a bit of an interesting choice for casting, because his character is really quite thick, but, you know, besotted with his wife and totally, you know, lives in her esteem.
Yeah. And she's great, Danielle Fahrenheit.
She's great.
Well.
And he's great in the part too. I thought he was really good there.
Yeah. Both of them actually had a great rapport in the film. And Rachel Blake as well was I really love Rachel Blake in this film.
I find her a bit of a cold actress in general.
But I think that was the point in the film.
Well, really. And I found myself thinking, so Jane, you know, I don't know how well I actually understood the Jane character. Like, she was... You know, obviously in a big moment in her life where, you know, she'd ended a marriage because she just didn't love her husband, even though on every level he seemed like a really nice guy. Probably a bit boring for her, I suspect, but, you know. And she's in this period where she's trying new things. She has the affair with the cop in her dance class. And she really tries to destroy a few things around her, like inserting herself into the life of this guy she had the one-night stand with. Mm-hmm. It's not entirely clear whether she's trying to do something with the neighbour, Vince Colosimo, whose wife she's a very good friend with. Mm. Is she actually just trying to be nice and offering him some money, or is she really trying to seduce him? That's never really quite clear.
It's never quite clear, no.
And the one time she tries to do the right thing, when she rings the police and says about, you know, what she saw that leads, you know, everything to kind of blow up, and where she... While the couple next door are in for police questioning as a result of her actions, she's looking after their child, their sick child, she's tidied their house.
Mm-hmm.
Those things, you know, just go wrong. You know, she can't win. And when she's dancing on her own at the end, I sort of thought, yeah, I don't really know where you're going as a person. I don't even know if I want to spend time with you. Whereas a lot of them I would find quite interesting people.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah, the part of this character is, you know, a really honourable man who's lost his way.
He has. But I also feel, you know, in terms of her, you look at her from her perspective and she's seeing this man she really likes. I mean, obviously
Jane?
Yeah, Jane. Yep. She really likes, you know, Anthony LaPaglia's character, Leon. And so in her shoes, you know, I know he's a married man and all the rest of it, but if you fall for somebody, you are falling for somebody.
But then the way, like, she inserts herself in with the wife in the dance class.
Yeah, that was a bit wrong. I found that.
I think she's quite a manipulative character as well.
Oh, she is. I mean, you know, I love Anthony LaPaglia's line after that he just had a bit of a heart issue, which is obviously his bottled up
and
tension
stress,
and stress. And he said, we're not having an affair. It's just a one night stand. Only happened just twice.
And then she kind of reacts and he goes, oh, look, I don't really mean that.
But yeah.
I think he probably did.
Yeah. But he did. like you said, I love my wife,
What else about the film? I mean, the lantana bush is an obvious metaphor. It's a really beautiful bush on the outside. Mm-hmm. And underneath is this really thick, spiky undergrowth.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
because of the body, the hidden secrets, which quite artfully you're led to believe is the bush across the road. But in fact,
it's somewhere completely different.
Yeah, exactly. Right. In that part of the world, but not really. That was really well done. It's interesting that Ray Lawrence has only made 3 films.
I know, Bliss,
Jindabyne, and this.
Yeah.
And this is the middle film.
That's right.
And he's gone to try and make some other films and never really gone anywhere. And from what I can tell, he seems quite comfortable
with
that.
Well, he was into commercials. I think he was a commercial director as well. I'm
not a fan of Bliss. I do need to watch Jindabyne. I suspect I'll really like it. And I do really like this. I'd like to see more of his work, but... It's just the 3 at this stage.
Well, I think it's whatever really what inspires you, really. And I think I don't mind filmmakers who make, so many films in so many certain years to be inspired. I think if he's made Lantana, which is amazing, it took a while for him to make that after Bliss. And I'm yet to see Jindabyne, but I'm sure I'll love that.
Well,
too.
So Charles Laughton only made the one film, which I think is fantastic, and which we'll do one day. I think it's called Night is the Hunter. Made the one film, and that was it. Just... and it's a wonderful film, but it leaves me wanting to see more.
Yeah. But what a great Australian film, though, really.
Oh, it is. And very mature for what we normally create as feature films.
Well, absolutely. And when I was watching it, I didn't even think of it as an Australian film. It was just such a good film. I didn't have just this, Aussie quirks or anything like that.
It just
felt like a good
but
movie.
But it declares itself as an Australian film up front because you open with the sound of cicadas and then, the camera sort of moving through that lantana bush.
Beautifully shot,
Australian
by the way.
Things.
Beautifully
shot. Yeah. But I agree. It was, I think I remember at the time thinking it felt like a European film. Yeah, it really was a relationship kind of film, but very, very firmly situated in the Australian context.
It was a good mystery relationship drama.
We haven't mentioned Geoffrey Rush yet. Geoffrey Rush, as soon as he started speaking, I thought, oh God, that voice. It's just a wonderful voice.
It is.
And when he's not doing characters like Barbarossa in the Pirates of the Caribbean, he's doing a particular kind of character, but when he kind of plays a normal person and you hear that voice, all I want to do is hear more of it.
Yeah.
It is a wonderful voice. Yeah, and it's not just the voice. It was a great performance.
Well, the thing is, what I love about Geoffrey Rush is that, even when he's not speaking, he doesn't speak that much. There's a few scenes where he's just reacting and you see what's going on there. And you can read so much into just the look. He's so amazing.
And he's so haggard. Even before, because he too has lost his young daughter through a murder. But you can see that this guy is carrying a lot of stuff, and then that much more so when his wife disappears. Such a great performance. There were just some things, and really it was 2 things. It was some performances, and we're going to disagree about Peter Phelps. We're obviously going to disagree, although not as violently, about Kerry Armstrong, and we'll disagree about Glenn Robbins. So there were those, particularly Phelps, but also... just the interconnectedness got that little bit too cute, even though I enjoyed the comedy at points.
Yeah. Okay, well, what will you give it?
I'm giving it 8. I think it's certainly a very good film. I think it's a particularly good film in the Australian context, but to bump it up for that reason, I feel like is almost a bit of cultural cringe. So, but just because a few things pulled me out of it, it's an 8 for me.
Okay, I'm giving it an 8 too, so we're going to agree on that. Look, to push it up to a 9 and a 10, I don't think it's, it's a classic of world cinema or anything like that, but it is still a very good movie, and I still think
I do think it's incredibly good.
It's, anybody who is listening now who hasn't seen Lantana, it is a great film, and it is definitely worthy of an 8.
And we've done our very best not to do spoilers and explain exactly who died or how.
Absolutely. So, enjoy it for yourself, but it really is definitely worth a watch. So, next episode is going to be really, really big.
We've got some big movies to talk about.
That's right. The 2 confessions. My confession for the next episode is Big Fish, which is the Tim Burton film.
From 2003. I've got The Big Lebowski, which I've never quite got around to watching.
That's the Coen Brothers film.
I think that's 98, something like that.
That's right.
And both of us are going back to watch
The Big Chill.
1983 film that has been seminal in getting old university friends back together again.
That's right. So what a big episode.
See us next time for a big time.
Filmmaker, film
under
watcher.
The big top.
See you next time.
Bye-bye.